This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Are social service agencies in Illinois caught in the middle of the state budget crisis, or are they in the crosshairs? Some directors are beginning to wonder if there's a strategy to eliminate them.
I do wonder, and it is one of the things that makes me quite angry.
In the latest interview in our series, Stretched Thinner, you'll hear that LifeSil actually saves the state money by enabling independent living. The nominee for Education Secretary is a proponent of school vouchers and is scheduled for a Senate confirmation vote tomorrow. Hear from the president of the Unit 5 Teachers Union why vouchers may not be a good idea. And find out how Kobe buffalo meat went viral. ISU social media analyst Nate Carpenter talks about the online impact of the ISU football recruit. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's February 6th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT. With additional support from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group, more information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Since our interview series Stretched Thin, LifeSil's financial situation has improved slightly. They were owed as much as $200,000 by the state of Illinois. The stopgap six-month budget at the end of 2016 helped, but the social service agency, which helps people with disabilities live independently, is again struggling to provide services that its director says actually saves the state money. She says Governor Rauner's pro-business agenda should include the social service businesses. The state budget impasse is in month 19 as part of our follow-up series, Stretched Thinner. LifeSil's advocacy and advancement director, Ricky Lee Beneke, says the state's on and off again money spigot makes managing LifeSil's programs difficult.
Right now, we are okay for the time being. Once again, we're looking forward and wondering how long we can continue to do that, just like so many others in the field.
It's sort of a stop-and-go sort of approach to budgeting. How hard does that make it for LifeSil to sort of plan and to know that you're going to be able to continue the programs that you have?
It makes it excruciatingly hard. We do not know, for example, what or anything is coming for the second half of FY17, which, of course, started January 1.
So what direction is LifeSil headed if a budget isn't reached soon, or if you continue to have this sort of, you know, you get some money but not all of it, and then you get some more money but not all of it? Where is LifeSil headed, do you think?
I think we're headed into uncharted waters, and that's what we are kind of planning for. We have never been in this situation before. We have never had to deal with this. So we are actually learning as we go, just like everyone else. Unfortunately, it does not look good.
When you and others with LifeSil talk with elected officials, state senators or representatives, what are you telling them and what are you hearing back?
We have been consistently, since the first budget address of the governors, we have been consistently giving them the message that not only are we as a business, a human service agency, affected, it is affecting the services of the people that we serve, the people with disabilities here in McLean County in our four service area. We have brought them stories of the consumers who are being affected. We have brought them stories of the consumers who have had great success living independently because of our services. So, well, as you've seen so far, we do not have anything to show for that.
When you share those stories with them, what is their reaction? What do they tell you?
For the most part, I get, we understand, you know, we are concerned, we appreciate all of the services, and we know the value of the services that you offer.
When we heard from you last May during our series Stretched Thin, you said you wanted politicians to be held accountable. Let's listen to a part of that May 2016 interview.
They are supposed to be going to Springfield, taking the voices of the people that they represent back and doing what's best for their constituents. And from what I've seen, they're not doing that. We have had a lot of outcry through many different districts, not just in ours, but throughout the state, of people going to the legislators and saying, we need to find a way to get this budget done. It's hurting too many people.
So that's you from May of 2016. Sounds a lot like you today. Are they being held accountable?
I don't see it. I don't see it unless it's behind the scenes. I think there are a lot more people, not only in social services and human service agencies and the nonprofits, that are getting, like myself, increasingly frustrated and angry. And I'm hoping that we will take that to the elections the next time that they're up.
That's difficult in Central Illinois when often there's only one candidate to choose from on the ballot.
True, but what a lot of people don't realize is that you do not have to cast your vote for that one person.
Core to LifeSIL's mission is advocacy, and in many cases, you're not so much going to bat for individuals as you are teaching them how to go to bat for themselves. How are those programs, those advocacy education programs, being affected?
Well, there is one that is federally funded, so that so far is continuing. The one-on-one, that is something that is state GRF, General Revenue Fund. So that is one of the programs that are in limbo right now.
Have you been able, in part, to see some of that advocacy come full circle? You've taught people to be advocates, and now they're having to advocate for the funding that they need for the programs to continue to teach them to have better advocacy skills. Are you sort of seeing that complete circle?
I am, absolutely, and I love it because I have people come to me and tell me, I called my legislator again today, or I emailed my legislator, or whatever. So it is great to see the voices coming out.
And that's in part what you teach your clients to do.
Absolutely.
Can you share some specifics about the service you offer, some of the services you offer, and how they've been affected? You mentioned the one that was general revenue funded. What about enabling individuals to lead lives that are more independent? What are those programs, and what's happening with them?
Well, so far we have had to eliminate one of the programs, and that is our educational advocacy program, where we help parents who have a child with a disability in school learn how to advocate for those services or accommodations that their child needs. Unfortunately, we are no longer able to offer that program. The other programs, like I said, it just is kind of a wait and see game.
So what do you tell a parent that calls you and says, hey, my child needs help, we need help with the situation in school? What does that conversation sound like?
It's sad, it's distressing. The parents don't know where else to go. We have one resource from Southern Illinois that we can refer them to a phone number where hopefully they may get a little bit of information over the phone.
What do you think? Is LifeSIL and other social service agencies caught in the middle? Or do you think this is sort of an unspoken strategy to eliminate funding in the long run and never restore it? Have you thought about that?
I have thought about that, yes. I am not sure exactly where my thoughts can go on that. We are a nonprofit. We have to remain bipartisan.
but being in the situation you're in, on the side that you're on, after this goes on for a certain amount of time, you have to wonder.
I do wonder. And it is one of the things that makes me quite angry, because we have seen human services for many years, long before the budget impasse even started, as being one of the services that the state continually cuts. We've had, I don't know, since 2008, either flat funding, the same funding from the previous year, or budget cuts. And it affects not only business, because, you know, we can't give our staff cost of living increases. We can't do a lot of things because we're getting cuts every year. And I guess it angers me because of the people that we serve. We serve people with disabilities. A lot of human service agencies throughout the state who serve people with disabilities, senior citizens, children, you name it, they are who are being affected by this. They're the 1 million plus people whose services throughout the state have been affected are some of our most vulnerable residents of the state of Illinois. Why should they have to pay because of the Illinois General Assembly's failure to do their job.
Provided the state isn't trying to just phase out such services and abandon people who need help, let's talk about the kind of money the state saves by enabling people to live independently. What's the ratio there? How much would they be spending if LifeSIL weren't here to help someone live independently as opposed to maybe in an institutional setting?
Well, to give you just an idea, there are 22 centers for independent living throughout the state. We are just one of those. One of our programs, which is the Community Reintegration Program, has saved the state millions of dollars. Add in all the other, you know, centers for independent living throughout the state who have the same programs, and it's close to billions of dollars that we're saving the state, yet we continue to get these cuts, or we continue to get paid pennies on the dollar for our services that we've provided. And with all the other programs, I mean, the cost of living independently is, depending on the level of the disability, at least half. You know, it's cheaper to live in the community with the proper services and supports out there than it is in any type of institution, nursing home or whatever. And it, I don't see that the state is really looking at that. They are just looking at where can we cut. You know, while the state is in an unprecedented place right now, the governor has been talking about what's good for business, bringing in business. What he doesn't realize is that there are already a lot of great businesses here in this state, saving the state a lot of money, helping millions of people in our state.
And LifeSIL is one of those businesses.
And LifeSIL is absolutely one of those. We should not be cutting and harming these businesses that save people money, and we should not be harming the people with disabilities, senior citizens, children, etc., that need this in order to live independently. If these services continue to go away, the state is going to be spending billions more dollars.
Ricky Lee Beneke is the Advocacy and Advancement Director for LifeSIL. She says social services in the community are closely integrated. For instance, if daycare funding is affected, then the parent could lose employment because there's no one to take care of their child. Or if transportation is cut, then people can't get to their jobs. Find all of our Stretched Thinner interviews at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jacksguarantee.com. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Coming up here, how Kobe buffalo meat blew up the internet last week. The interview is ahead during Sound Ideas. The U.S. Senate will hold a confirmation vote this week on Education Secretary nominee Betsy DeVos. She's a big proponent of school vouchers, allowing parents to use state money to go to school of their choice rather than to the nearest public school. WGLT has interviewed school administrators, State Senator Bill Brady, on this topic. Brady is enthusiastic about the prospects for expanded vouchers. Carl Gaeke is cool on the idea. He's the president of the Unit 5 Education Association. In this conversation with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Gaeke says he's not a big fan of the voucher system.
When you're talking about vouchers, what you're talking about is taking money from the public schools that we have right now and transferring it to somewhere that is not regulated. For example, the public schools are all licensed educators, right? All public schools have licensed educators. When you take a voucher and go to, say, a for-profit charter school, those schools aren't bound by the same licensure procedures that we are here in Illinois, and they don't have the same accountability that we do here in Illinois in the public schools.
Senator Brady was arguing, though, that should not parents have the right to choose where their students go?
They do right now. they can choose to send their children to a private school, but the voucher system would take the public-funded money away from public schools and divert it to potentially a for-profit charter school that has the ability to decide who they will accept and who they won't accept.
District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley has talked on our air about how the dollars for each student coming from the state really do more than just pay for that student's instruction. They help maintain the apparatus, the administrative structure, the facilities. Mm-hmm. Senator Brady responds by saying, yes, public schools have a tremendous capital advantage. How do you fall in that particular dynamic? Is the money that comes strictly for students? Is it for other purposes, and how much does that impact the overall public school apparatus?
I'm not sure you can equate a dollar-for-dollar ratio from child to the amount of funding, right? We get a certain amount of funding for each child, but it's not necessarily all spent in the same way. It's not like if you get $8,000 for a child, $8,000 is spent directly on that student, but it goes into a larger pool, and then that pool services every single child that comes through the doors. Whether they have high needs or exceptional needs or low needs, we service every single student in the public schools and make sure that every single student has a high quality public education, and it's free.
More private schools, proponents of vouchers argue, would provide opportunities for specialization for schools providing extra expertise in math, science, sports training, or college prep, or whatever. Is that a useful idea in support of vouchers?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we need to be very clear about is that all of those programs can and do exist in the public schools right now. And for example, if you wanted a school that specialized in something, you can create a public magnet school. And in fact, there are even public charter schools. And public charter schools are bound by the exact same regulations that any other public school is, ensuring again that all those children have access to a high quality education. And so when you start to take away the, you know, some people would call it red tape or bureaucratic red tape, that the regulation, then what you don't have is any sort of oversight over those schools. And so, you know, right now in Illinois, all public schools are held to the same level of accountability. That's not true of private for-profit schools.
Should it be, if the deal is made to make the dollars per student portable?
Should they be held to the same standards?
Right.
Absolutely.
What would that do to their ability to function, and how would they adjust to that?
I don't know that I can even answer that question. I'm not sure. I mean, what I can tell you is that there are states that have started this program. You know, you look across the border to Michigan, right? In Michigan, they have a voucher program, and what they found is that as people move, there are places where the public schools actually have to close because they have such low enrollment. Well, the people that live there still need a public school, and so then the students are traveling farther distances. And what they're also finding, if you go ahead and look over Michigan, is that the charter schools aren't necessarily providing any higher level of education than the regular public schools are.
Why not?
I'm not sure why they're not.
I mean, is it because the results for private institutions now are typically inflated because they're schools of choice?
I mean, it's hard to say.
For the wealthy?
In some cases, they are. But, you know, when you've got a portability system like that, it in some ways can level the field for those institutions, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they will. And in some cases, what happens is, you know, your voucher, if you want to go to this school, isn't enough. And so then they charge you a tuition on top of the voucher, which means that it's still not an equitable chance for a student to get into that school.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with the Unit 5 Education Association head, Carl Gehke. Senator Brady articulated an argument that vouchers disproportionately help lower income students because their families don't have the wherewithal to pay for full tuition at a private institution, that it would make them potentially able to go to a private institution not having to pay the full tuition. Is there merit to that argument for vouchers?
Again, if you look to places that have instituted this, states that have instituted voucher programs, you will find that that's not actually what happens. That it's not actually the low-income students that leave, but it's generally the higher-income students that tend to leave.
Where does that place public schools in that sort of hybrid system?
Well, it leaves them with less resources for the students that aren't able to leave. For example, if you've got a private school, they don't necessarily provide transportation. You know, a public school is required to provide transportation to students. There's certain regulations that require us to provide transportation. When you take a student and put them in a non-public school, they don't have the same regulation to provide transportation. And so the question becomes, how do those children get there? Who has the ability to transport their children to that school where they don't provide transportation?
Do you buy the pro-voucher argument that competition between schools is increased, leading to greater efficiency and results in all schools?
No. I don't think it's been proven anywhere. I don't think there are a lot of cases where there is competition and all of a sudden schools start doing better. I mean, in the public schools, and really in any school, we're not working with a product. We're working with people. And people do well or don't do well. And having lots of different options doesn't mean that people are all of a sudden going to do better, right? In the public schools, we work hard to make sure every child that walks through that door has high-quality access public education, and it's free for them.
Do you have concerns on any constitutional grounds from government subsidizing private schools if they have a particular belief system that they are also adding to the regular curriculum?
Well, we do have a separation of church and state. It's part of our democracy. And I mean, what concerns me more than that is the idea that someone's tax dollars would be going to that institution as opposed to what is provided by the public right now.
Do vouchers make a sustainable public school system impossible? Can a hybrid system exist?
I think they can exist. I think they can exist, but I guess what I would argue right now is that Illinois' schools are high quality. And we have, especially here in McLean County, if you look to any of the public schools in McLean County, we have high quality schools in McLean County. And so I'm not particularly worried about it in our little microcosm, but when you think about the nation at large, that's what makes me worried about the voucher system is that, you know, what they found in places like Oklahoma City is that the charter moves in and the neighborhood school closes down, and then the charter buys up the public building. And then at times, these private charters, and I want to be very clear about that, private, can just leave town and they can close overnight. Quick Google search will find you examples of that, where the school closes down overnight, very little notice to parents or students, and now those students have to go somewhere again. And where do they go? They go back to the public schools. You know, if you look around in Detroit, you'll find actually just recently an interview with a young lady who talked about having gone to 16 different schools with her vouchers trying to find a school. And she talks about how where she lives, the closest public high school is 17 miles away from her house in Detroit. But outside in the suburbs, there are, I think she mentioned like 6 or 7 in a 5-mile radius. And, you know, it's just people moving, right? And I guess I think it shouldn't matter what zip code you live in. You should have access to a free, high-quality public education.
Carl Gaeke is the head of the teachers union for Unit 5 schools in McLean and Woodford counties. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. The Senate is expected to vote tomorrow on President Trump's education secretary nominee, Betsy DeVos, a proponent of school vouchers. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The medical marijuana program in Illinois is in its early stages, so many growers and patients are still learning as they go. IPR's Rich Eger has more.
Hey there. I got a question for you. What are your thoughts on weed? Are you for it or against it?
That is from the short film documentary, Prescription Pot, The Journey for Pain Relief. It was put together by Western Illinois University student Adam Colgan. Colgan says the day his journey began is stamped in his mind.
January 22nd, 2011.
That's the first time he ever tried snowboarding.
And fell on my ass, which is totally normal and completely fine. Except it gave me arthritis.
And rheumatoid arthritis is one of 40 qualifying conditions included in Illinois' medical marijuana pilot program. After an on-campus screening of his documentary, Colgan explained how he tried and tried to find something that would relieve his pain.
Everything from mild pain relievers like Advil and Tylenol all the way up to methotrexate, which is a very strong medication with some pretty bad side effects, and a lot of the side effects haven't been worth it for me.
In his search for pain relief, Colgan came across the possibility of using medical marijuana. His doctor agreed to prescribe it, but that was just the first step in Colgan's journey. The group Medical Cannabis Outreach in Colgan's hometown of Canton helped guide him through a lengthy process that included completing a detailed application form, getting fingerprinted, and proving residency. Colgan finally got his ID in March 2016 and says it changed his life. He says for the first time in 5 years, he could walk without pain. Colgan still cannot walk into the corner drugstore and buy medical marijuana. It's sold only at state-licensed dispensaries. He goes to one in Canton. It sells a variety of medical marijuana products that are produced at cultivation centers across the state. The cultivation center, Nature's Grace and Wellness, sits behind a tall chain-link fence at the end of a long and winding gravel driveway. A single-story red building with white trim looks like a warehouse. It rises from among the farm fields just outside the small Fulton County town of Vermont. All the growing is done indoors at Nature's Grace and Wellness, and there is a lot of security, including cameras pointed in every direction. The roughly 28 full-time employees must pass through 2 security checkpoints. They're required to change into scrubs at work. All the pockets are sewn shut on their uniforms. They must also walk through a boot bath and an air wash. This is to remove potential contaminants. At Nature's Grace and Wellness, a marijuana plant's life begins in the vegetation room, where hundreds of overhead 1,000-watt high-pressure sodium lights brighten the room 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Chief Financial Officer Larry O'Hearn says the monthly electric bill is around $20,000.
We were projected to have a $40,000 power bill, so we feel really fortunate that it's as low as it is.
Larger plants line the floor from the front to the back of the giant growing room. Smaller plants fill shelves around the room. As you can hear, fans constantly move the air to keep it from getting too warm. O'Hearn's son, Tim, is the chief operating officer of the business. He says they keep close tabs on each and every plant.
So you'll see every plant has a number of identifying tags, which identify its date of planting, the strain variety, and a unique barcode so the plant can always be tracked throughout its entire life cycle.
That's not just for security. The O'Hearns say this helps them learn what does and does not work with their plants. The O'Hearns have a big stake in making this work, and it's not just the financial investment. Larry O'Hearn says it's also personal.
My son Tim contracted MS, was diagnosed with MS, and cannabis was a viable option for MS.
Tim O'Hearn still gets around, and he leads us into another huge room. Plants come here for the next stage of their development.
This seems like a harsher light than in the other room.
Sunglasses are a good thing.
Yeah, it can be very bright, especially when all of these are on, which later this week all the lights in this room will be on as more plants come in from the room we were just in.
It's also quite warm in this room. Employee Christian Herring is sweating a bit as he prunes plants.
We check temps every day. We keep it around 74, 75 degrees, so it's not too bad, but moving around, yeah, you get sweating a lot.
Everything at Nature's Grace and Wellness is carefully controlled. Larry O'Hearn says no pesticides are used. He says the rooms are emptied after every harvest, completely clean, top to bottom, and then baked at 120 degrees for 2 days to sterilize them. He says the business does as much as possible to help the marijuana grow.
These plants are like thoroughbreds. We ask this plant to grow and to do things that we normally wouldn't ask a plant to do in order to get the highest THC strains. This plant cannot have a bad day.
Once the plants finish growing, workers clean the buds and flowers before the marijuana is processed. The O'Hearns decline to reveal much about their extraction process. It's proprietary, and this is a highly competitive business. Tim O'Hearn says they go through several steps before coming up with the stuff they're looking for.
It is like a sap. It's like a really sticky, thick oil. So from that sticky, thick oil we use, we make our edibles, topicals, and our line of vape products from that.
Adam Colgan, the Western Illinois University student we heard from earlier, is still experimenting to figure out which products work best for him.
I'm always rotating between different strains and different cultivators, but I always go back to Nature's Grace and Wellness. I've got quite a few of their like vape pens and quite a few different strains of theirs that I continuously go back to.
Colgan says if he needs immediate pain relief, he smokes a bit of marijuana. Otherwise, he'll choose a cookie or chocolate or some other edible form of the drug. And through trial and error, he's learned how much he can tolerate.
I don't want to be walking around everywhere looking like a zombie. That's not my goal, and that's not going to get me anywhere.
Despite the learning curve regarding his tolerance, and even though the application process was lengthy and detailed, Colgan says he's glad he found medical marijuana.
I do thank the state of Illinois for instituting this. It has absolutely 100% changed my life for the better, and I could not be more thankful that they've implemented it.
But medical marijuana is still considered a pilot program in Illinois, and advocates have struggled to get more qualifying medical conditions included in it. Colgan says there is still a stigma associated with medical marijuana. He suggests people get over it. Colgan says the medical marijuana users he's met are not a bunch of stoners. He says they're just normal people looking for pain relief. Rich Ugger reporting.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to reggae legend Peter Tosh, Legalize It, on Sound Ideas.
Size it. Legalize it, yeah, yeah, and I will advertise it. Some call it
listening to Sound Ideas.
Forget about your four-leaf clover. Don't bother picking up that penny. It's brains, not luck, that will get you to triumph at GLT Trivia Night, March 4th at the Castle Theater.
It's going down for it.
Assemble your team and get ready to take on the competition in a battle of the brains. So put that horseshoe back on the horse and leave luck at the door at GLT Trivia Night, March 4th at the Castle Theater. More info at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Central Illinois Regional Airport at Bloomington-Normal, with Allegiant flights to Orlando-Sanford and Tampa-St. Pete, Florida, along with service by Delta and American. Information at CIRA.com. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. A Bloomington Normal resident played a role in Sunday's Super Bowl, but he's not a player. Doug Rosenbaum is an NFL referee and worked the big game for the second time. In a 2011 interview, Rosenbaum told GLT's Charlie Schlenker he loves the work because he likes being on the field.
It certainly, starting out anyway, was not for the money or for... you know, for lack of getting yelled at by fans by any means, but it was really to give something back to the sports that I participated in, both in high school and in college. And so it was just a way for me to give something back. The alternative was you could go into coaching, but we did have, or still do have, a large contingency of officials here in the Bloomington Normal area, and it was really kind of a hot spot for a lot of officials growing up, and one of them being Wayne Meese, who I think when I was in college was working in the Big Ten, and then Steve Newman, who's now a replay assistant in the Big Ten, John Sullivan, Chuck Feeney, were all guys that were all mentors and kind of pointed me in the right direction. So, you know, just giving something back, and I learned to love it, and it was, you know.
What about it do you love, though?
You know, I think it's not only, you know, being out on the field and being part of the game again anyway. I love being with the guys that you work with. It's a unique group of individuals, and they come from all walks of life, everything from attorneys to school teachers to principals to financial planners, pilots, you name it. It's kind of, you know, we have a lot, a big variety of guys that also have full-time jobs, and that's what makes us kind of unique from that standpoint, is that we're not full-time employees of the National Football League, but it's kind of a, you know, it started out as a hobby for most of us.
How much are you together on the road?
The crew involves seven officials and two replays, so there's nine of us. We do stay together the whole season, and so that would be for like 16 regular season games and then four preseason games. So that's 20 weeks, and then we are at clinics together for, you know, for another couple more weekends and stuff. So it becomes your second family.
And if you're the top-rated crew, maybe you get to do the Super Bowl.
And exactly. The usually the top-rated crews will work in the wild card round or the divisional round, and that's, you know, generally the top eight crews. And then for the championship game and the Super Bowl, that's an individual selection. It's usually your top 3 to 5 individuals in each position.
What makes a tight crew, and how much actual teamwork is there other than just handling your own section of the field and your own task?
There's a tremendous amount of teamwork involved when you go on the field with seven other officials. You have to trust that your partners are going to do their job looking in their particular area. And, you know, that trust, you know, it's what makes really the crew work in itself anyway, and you've got to have people that are willing to step up at times and make particular calls. You also have to have officials that are willing to, you know, perhaps officiate outside of their box, so to speak, to help out a partner. Tight catches on the sideline, for instance, or tight catches in the end zone, fumbles, what have you. You know, the guy that's closest to the play may not have the best angle of that particular particular play, so you've just got to have that continuity between the guys that you're working with, and you've got to have that trust that those guys will step up and make the call.
You've gone from high school officiating to college Division III to Division I to Canadian football to the NFL in 2001 to the playoffs and to the Super Bowl. What were the challenges you faced in this one?
it's controlling your emotions. When I look back, no matter what you do, there's hype. There's hype involved in the coin toss. There's hype involved in the national anthem. There's hype involved in the kickoff. And that hype is exaggerated to a certain degree because it is entertainment. So that exaggeration just kind of magnifies it, you know, 10 times anyway. So maintaining your control of your emotions so you don't get caught up in a lot of the hype was probably the major thing that other officials who have worked at Super Bowl had suggested to me and made the comment anyway, is, you know, don't get caught up in with your emotions and the hype.
How do you tamp that down? I mean, what mental work do you go through to keep a lid on it?
Just the process that you would normally go through just during the regular season is a lot of what I did, and that's focusing on that this is just a football game, even though the stakes are a lot higher, but it is just another football game from that approach. And, running through your keys, running through the procedures that we do in between downs. All of us have a different strategy when we're on the field of what we're doing during the dead time. Anyway, so I was focusing on that, making sure that all that was kind of in line when you walked out on the field. And again, just treating it like a regular season game from that standpoint, even though,
And were you successful?
Yes, I did feel comfortable. It did take me 3-4 minutes anyway getting into the game to get into your routine, just simply because of, it was the final game of the season, and there were a lot of eyes that were watching that particular game. So, yes, I was successful in getting through that process.
How has review affected how you feel about your work and how you go about it?
To me personally, I like it. I like it from the standpoint that we officials, we're human. We're going to make mistakes on the field, mistakes on catches or fumbles. That all comes into play into the game. So it's kind of comforting to know that they've got this system put into place where it can be challenged on a particular play, where a coach he actually has coaches up in the press box that are watching the TV monitors and what have you while the game's going on, and they're actually responsible for buzzing down to the head coach to let them know whether to challenge a play or not. But I like it from the aspect of if I do make a mistake, it's nice to know that it can be corrected and it can be corrected right away, and I don't have to be concerned about whether my judgment in that particular play meant winning or losing the particular game anyway. So I can get on the airplane on my trip home anyway and at least feel halfway comfortable that, you gave it your best shot and the game was officiated correctly.
What's your most memorable mistake?
Oh, I've had a lot of them, Charlie. <It's>, and I say that there's a lot of them that I scratch my head on anyway. I don't know if they're mistakes or not, but one of my memorable games was early in my career, my second year in the league. I was assigned a playoff game that involved the New York Giants and the San Francisco 49ers. And there was a field goal attempt that on the very last play where the field goal holder muffed the snap, and eventually there was a ball thrown and some pass interference occurred, and that wasn't called, and the Giants ended up losing by, I think, 2 points in that particular play anyway. And hindsight's a wonderful thing. And we go back and look at the film, and we probably should have had a flag on the play and given New York another opportunity to kick that field goal. But, there was a lot of variables in that particular game anyway that made it interesting.
How do you avoid becoming gun-shy once you've done something like that?
And again, it's kind of experience and it's a mental, it's kind of, what do I want to say, a lot of mental looking at plays on video and I'm going to call it mental toughness, I guess, anyway. But you have to work your way through that. You have to particularly when you're on the field, and let's say I may have made a pass interference call and it made him perhaps could have been incorrect or whatever. And the thing is, though, I have to get right back into the right frame of mind right away, because the very next play could come right at me again, and where I need to make a judgment call on whether it might be pass interference or a catch, no catch type situation. So it's there's a process there that is kind of a mental process that you've when you make the call, you got to accept that you made the call, right or wrong. If it happens to be wrong, you can't worry about it now, because it's history, and you got to move on to the next play.
In tennis, Andre Agassi always talked about, after a point, doing the exact same thing as a physical key to help you get back into the mental frame that you need to resume the play. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of correlation there to a lot of different professional sports, golf, tennis, being is that, you know, you've got to get back into that routine, and you've got whether it's ball striking or whether it's officiating, you need to get right back into that routine as soon as possible. If you don't, you just set yourself up for another miss hit or another error.
So what is the routine? What is the physical process that you do to reset mentally as well?
You just have to tell yourself, you've got to move on beyond this play. You've got to accept it, and you got to be able to accept the criticism, you know, after the game is over. And that criticism may be in the form of learning. It's constructive criticism. I mean, they're not there to yell at you by any means, but you need to learn from it.
NFL referee Doug Rosenbaum qualified for the Super Bowl 51 officiating crew by being one of the top-ranked regular season referees evaluated by his peers. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker in 2011. The Super Bowl took a back seat on social media for at least several hours to an unknown Illinois State University recruit who dominated Facebook and Twitter for more than a day last week. Kansas high school football player Kobe Buffalo Meat literally made headlines when his decision to play at ISU was made public. GLT's Willis Kern has more.
Not many outside his hometown of Lawrence, Kansas, knew much about Kobe Buffalo Meat, but that all changed Wednesday, National Letter of Intent Day, when many college sports teams were able to sign players out of high school. Buffalo Meat inked with the Redbirds and became an instant star. His name was a top national trend on Twitter, and media outlets ESPN, The New York Times, Sports Illustrated, and many others all featured online material about Buffalo Meat. Celebrities picked up on the sensation. Key and Peele, who made famous a routine about oddly named football players, tweeted back and forth to Buffalo Meat and the millions of their followers. Even Jimmy Kimmel brought the ISU recruit onto his show.
A couple people call me Beef, and the head coach calls me Meat.
Meat! I like Meat. That's a good one. I think the fans at Illinois State should definitely chant Meat when you come on the field. Well, thank you.
I wouldn't mind it.
Best of luck at the school. I'm definitely going to buy your jersey as soon as you you get one, all right?
With us here to talk about how this happened is Nate Carpenter. He's Convergence Media Specialist and Director of Illinois State University's Social Media Analytics Command Center. Thanks for being here, Nate.
Thank you very much for having me.
So does this set the record of Illinois State mentions on social media?
Since we've been keeping track, yes, it does. And we've seen it really blow out of the water, previous mentions, really over the past year. Even looking at this past month, we've had some significant spikes of activity surrounding the men's basketball team's victory. Victory over Wichita State, even a pretty big victory over Evansville. And this one is, we're talking multitudes more activity.
Multitudes as in thousands of times? I mean,
we're talking thousands, yeah. Thousands more posts.
Yeah, what are the metrics you use to analyze these sorts of things?
Sure. So first, I should let you know that we are only studying him in relationship to Illinois State University. We're talking hundreds of thousands, if not millions of tweets out there that are talking about Kobe directly. We're just looking at any mentions and retweets of our football channels, anybody mentioning Illinois State accounts or using the words Illinois State or ISU in conjunction with his name. And so when I say multitudes more, when we had big spikes during the Wichita State game, we were seeing maybe 500 tweets in an hour. And in this case, we were seeing, I think we topped out at close to 5,000 tweets within an hour, just talking about Illinois State and Kobe together.
Amazing. amazing. How does this social media activity compare to other occurrences? Let's take, for example, the Stranger Things SAG Awards speech that featured a bewildered Winona Ryder just the other night. How does this measure up to something like that?
It's not quite as large as something like that. I guess one of the things that we looked at during that day was how long he was trending on Twitter. And Kobe Buffalo Meat, just as a term on Twitter, just his name, was trending for 4 hours straight, and he made it as far as the top seven in the United States. And I think the only things that were really outperforming that day were National Signing Day, of course, Beyonce's twins, and then also there were all sorts of things going on with cabinet committee selections and confirmation hearings in the Senate. And so really, for him to jump that quickly into that number seven spot and stay there for a couple of hours during the day is that does not happen very often to very many people.
Sports is a subset of entertainment in society. Mm-hmm. So you would imagine that something like as big as the SAG Awards or if it's the Golden Globes or the Academy Awards, they're going to get a bigger play just because more people are interested in that, right? Mm-hmm.
That's correct. Yes. Yeah. So SAG Awards will get bigger play. On the other hand, this was expanding outside the sports realm. And even in traditional forms of media that we can follow on the internet, we were seeing major coverage in newspapers across the board and the story being talked about not just in the sports sections. So that's a good indicator of activity beyond what we would expect.
Obviously, the name Kobe Buffalo Meat, that's the hook here. But is there anything else at play, such as how he responded to this, that helped make it the sensation that it turned out to be?
Well, his response was really, really kind of fun because I don't think he realized how famous he was becoming right at that moment. There have been a series of interviews, from Chicago Tribune, from local TV stations, and on Jimmy Kimmel Live, he was in class during a certain hour, and he had already signed. There were other teammates around, and they already made a big deal about that. So he knew he was getting a lot of tweets. But I think within an hour after him getting activity, he realized that there was something really overwhelming going on, and he was very, really humble about this. So this wasn't I'm a star moment. This was somebody really being put in the limelight in a way that says, wow, I can't believe I'm here.
How can this impact future publicity for the ISU football team, which is already very good and could soon again contend for a national championship? How is having Kobe Buffalo Meat on your team going to help?
Well, first of all, we've already received national attention in ways that we just haven't seen, even while performing well on the field. And so this has already put the name Illinois State into the minds of many who will be following him. So even when the story starts to fade out a bit, once we get into training season, and that, from what I understand, Kobe Buffalo Meat won't be able to start playing until 2018. There will be reminder of this. And again, that name has really been firmly implanted. So I think there will be discussion, especially when he makes some excellent plays. I really look forward to, I guess, the poeticness of him playing against North Dakota State and can imagine some excellent comparisons there.
The headlines with the bison devour buffalo meat or vice versa. That would be better. The vice versa would be
much more preferable.
Definitely. Bison, of course, being the nickname for North Dakota State's powerful football team. Nate Carpenter directs ISU's Smack Lab. That's the Social Media Analytics Command Center. Thanks for coming over.
Thank you very much.
Carpenter spoke with GLT's Willis Kern. Redbird fans may have to wait a while to see Buffalo Meat in a game at Hancock Stadium because he only recently started playing high school football. His development will follow a long curve as he sets out this fall taking online classes part-time. He'll then enroll full-time at ISU next January, redshirt the fall of 2018, and begin playing in 2019. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. At our website, find this show along with individual interviews. Thanks to Willis Kern and Charlie Schlenker. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post your comments to facebook.com/WGLTFM.